Hello, everybody. This is Georgianne Hughes, and this is The Bite Show. And we are really blessed to have Joseph P. Farrell with us right now. And we're going to be talking about his new book, Covert Wars and Breakaway Civilizations. And this is going to be a whopper doozy. Well, it will.
Hi, George.
Hi, Joseph. You put a lot of research into this book. My gosh.
Yeah, I did. And I have to tell people a little story about this book. It's part of a series that kind of little sub-series that I began with Saucer, Swastikas, and Psyops.
Yeah.
About this breakaway civilization idea. And it's not my idea. It's actually Richard Dolan's idea. You had him on your show.
Yes.
And, that idea just really grabs me. I just think that's, for any number of reasons, I think it's an important idea. But anyway, this book was written under duress.
Oh, my goodness.
Because I finished up... this last summer, I finished up the sequel to Babylon's Banksters,
mm-hmm.
and I no sooner got that book done and sent off to the publisher than somebody on Facebook messaged me and said, "Oh, I see your new book is already up at Amazon," and I'm thinking, "It can't be." So I looked over at Amazon, and my other publisher had put up Covert Wars and Breakaway Civilizations for pre-sale at Amazon.
Oh, my goodness.
And I hadn't even started writing the book yet.
Oh, my gosh, Joseph.
You know the story. I sat here for 2 months growling and complaining. And,
yes, I heard you growl.
reading furiously, trying to research this book and write it. because my other publisher had put it up on Amazon that it was going to be out and available by the end of November. I was reading just an awful lot and writing, it seemed like nonstop. So when I got done with this book, I told myself I'm taking a vacation from writing for at least 3 months.
You deserve it. Oh,
yeah.
Oh.
But yeah, there was a lot of research that went into it, and just to let people know, this is part of a little kind of mini series, sub series of books again, and I do plan on at least one more book in that series.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh. Well, what do you mean by the matrix of a breakaway civilization, Joseph?
Well, that's something I started talking about in Saucers, Swastikas, and Psyops, and I really got the term from a fellow that I cited in that book by the name of Carol Quigley.
Yeah.
The famous Georgetown professor of history.
Mm-hmm.
And he used the term matrix in the sense of a crystal. You know, a crystal grows in a matrix. It grows in the surrounding rock that's called the matrix. Well, he used that metaphor, that analogy, to describe the growth of civilizations. They have to have a certain context in which they grow, and that context forms the way they look.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was a good analogy for this breakaway civilization idea of Richard Dolan's, because Dolan puts his finger on a number of points that I just think are very, very significant. And, I wanted to investigate them. And one of the things that he very clearly in his books points out, UFOs and the national security state. And again, if your listeners are not familiar with those books, they are just absolutely essential reading for anybody interested in the subject of UFOs and the impact that they've had. Because the impact has been profound. We may not, I don't care where you stand on the issue of UFOs, if you believe that they exist or you don't believe they exist, or you believe they're extraterrestrial or they're not extraterrestrial, that's really beside the point, because the point of his books is that regardless of where one stands in terms of the issue, they have had an enormous effect, an enormous influence on this, you know, national security police state that we live in now.
Yeah.
They've helped shape it. They've helped mold it. But the other thing that he said in I think it was the second volume of his UFOs in the national security state, the other thing that he said was also very significant, that he thinks that this whole breakaway civilization got its part of its matrix, got its cultural feel from the Cold War. And that, you know, those two things, Cold War and UFOs, they seem so disrelated. They seem so far apart from each other. But I thought that's really a very, very profound insight. And that's kind of the approach I'm taking in this book, is looking at how did the Cold War affect the emergence of this breakaway group? And how did it affect the culture? And then how would that culture in turn have dealt with the phenomenon of UFOs? And when you put all that together, the answer is rather astonishing.
Well, the whole subject is...
Yeah, it is. It's very
fascinating.
Intriguing. It's very intriguing. You know, the idea that you have a group of humans on this planet...
Yeah.
With a completely different type of civilization. And that's the other thing I get into, not so much in saucers, swastikas, and psyops, but definitely in this book, is a consideration of what sort of technological level would they be at?
Yeah.
You know, why would they be considered a breakaway group at all? And the answer that I came to... it's kind of long and convoluted, but I'm going to try and shorten. I'm going to try and shorten what I think is the case here.
Okay.
Let's look at the phenomenon of UFOs just in general. They clearly are something, and clearly some of them exhibit signatures or signs that they are a technology.
Yes.
All right. And that technology, if you look at the behavioral characteristics of UFOs, you know, I'm not arguing for any particular hypothesis of their origin. I'm just kind of trying to put myself in the shoes of what would a government analyst looking at all of this really think.
Yeah.
All right. And, you know, putting yourself in those shoes, well, some of them are clearly the product of a technology. Some of them are clearly intelligently controlled.
Mm-hmm.
And clearly that technology, at least at the public human level, exceeds what we're capable of. So we're dealing with something extraordinary. And if it's not ours, then we'd better jolly well be able to get to that technological capability quickly.
Yeah.
Because, and here's, you know, here's the curveball, and this, I spent a whole chapter talking about this in the book, because some of these UFOs have this predilection for hanging around our nuclear sites.
Yes.
Our ICBMs, you know, yeah. even our nuclear tests back when we were doing it in the atmosphere. So, you know, clearly that little indicator right there is a potential national security issue right there.
Mm-hmm.
So this means, you know, that we're dealing with something extraordinary, and therefore, if you apply the Kardashev civilization classes to it, what do you have? Now, let me rehearse what those classes are once again. I first talked about them all the way back with the very first book in all of this alternative stuff that I wrote, which is the Giza Death Star.
Yeah.
Because this classification system is fundamental to approaching these types of technology issues. The Kardashev classification system is that a class one civilization, a genuinely advanced technological civilization, would require the energy resources of an entire planet to sustain itself.
Oh, boy.
All right. A class two civilization would require the energy output or resources of an entire star to sustain itself. And the most advanced civilization type, a class three civilization, would require the energy output of an entire galaxy.
Oh my God!
To sustain itself. Yeah, I mean, you know, you're growing in that classification scheme by an exponential scale.
Yeah.
Between each level. So, if you look at that classification system and then compare it to UFOs.
Mm-hmm.
You're dealing with a technology that would appear to be able to manipulate energy systems at least a class one civilization level. And why do I say that? Because, again, you're dealing with signatures, physics signatures, that exceed currently known, and I stress the word known, human ability.
Yeah.
You're dealing with something that appears to be able to tinker with the fabric of space-time itself, and therefore at least capable of manipulating systems on a planetary scale. Are you with me so far?
Oh, yeah.
All right. Now, let's look at that and then look at what I call the feral corollaries to the Kardashev classification scheme. All right?
Mm-hmm.
Let's say then that you're sitting there in your national security, you know, conference rooms with other experts and you're considering the UFO phenomenon. And remember, hovering in the background, you've also got to deal and worry about the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
So the first thing that you're going to be thinking about as you're looking at all of this and considering all of its vast implications is, number one, we've got to have a heck of a lot of money.
Oh, yeah.
To deal with all of this, all right? Because the feral corollary is, you may be able to manipulate a system on a scale beyond your current civilization level if you can leverage it.
Yeah.
You know, to borrow the economic term.
Yeah.
So in other words, you're going to require, first of all, you're going to require class one civilization financing in order to be able to replicate or emulate the science and physics evident in UFOs, considering them to be class one phenomena. Follow me?
Yeah.
So you're going, by the nature of the case, at the end of World War II, all of a sudden, with the appearance of UFOs on the scene and the demise of Nazi Germany, the rise of the Soviet Union as the potential threat to the West, you're confronted with two things simultaneously, and both of them are going to require an immense amount of financing.
Mm.
And all of that's going to have to be hidden. Now, when I'm stressing this class one phenomenon because, again, it's going to require the ability to manipulate systems on a planetary scale.
Yeah.
To create the systems, therefore, able to do that, you are going to require almost the energy of the planet, and therefore you're going to require a vast system of finance. And here's the bigger problem is if that's the case, you can't go public and say, hey, we're going to suck the very lifeblood out of every human being on Earth in order to meet this threat. You're going to have to create a hidden system of finance that's huge.
Yeah, and that's where austerity comes in, I think.
Well, no.
No,
this is so huge that no austerity in national budgets is going to even come close to the dramatic amount of money that's needed.
Mm.
You're going to have to create a system of huge financial fraud.
Yes.
And this is where I think ultimately we have to look at these bearer bond scandals that I've been talking about on my website, all the gold rehypothecation. I think that what you have at the end of World War II is not only this secretive agreement between the Western oligarchs and the post-war Nazis to to launder all that Nazi loot. It's for precisely this reason. You're confronting the Soviet Union. You're having to rebuild Europe. So in other words, all of this money has to remain off the books.
Yeah.
Because it's going to become a huge political slush fund.
Oh.
You follow me here?
Yes.
It is beyond the black budget in its size.
Yeah.
It is totally hidden. It's connected to vast systems, underground systems of financing. It's therefore intimately connected with the international mafia, with international crime, with international drug traffic, and so on and so forth. It's intimately connected to that because it has to be. It has to be huge, and it has to be completely unaccountable. It can't even be part of the black budget. You follow me? This is even more black. The other thing that this is going to require, therefore, as you're setting up your political slush fund to deal with the Soviet Union, to contain the Soviet Union and all of that, is you're going to have to strike the same deal that you just struck with the Nazis with the Japanese.
Oh, gee.
Why the Japanese? Very simple. Because when the Japanese invaded China, and then after the beginning of the Pacific War, you know, Indochina and Malaya and Indonesia and so on, the Japanese did exactly what the Nazis did. They sucked every bit of wealth out of their conquests that they could. Now, in the Orient's case, this was a heck of a lot of gold.
Yeah.
It was a massive amount of bullion. And the interesting thing, as far as I can tell, and I recount this in the book, Georgianne, is that this amount of bullion was never really properly a part of the official bullion figures of the world. All of this Oriental gold was kept completely apart from that. So you have two sources of a vast amount of wealth that were created and then rehypothecated over and over and over again to generate an enormous system, a fiat system of enormous hidden, and this is the key word, hidden leverage.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
Now, if people are having difficulty following all that, and you know, I'm condensing massive amounts of material from the book, all right? I'm just trying to kind of give everybody a high overview. If people are having difficulty wrapping their mind around a hidden system of finance, there's one thing I want them to bear in mind. When the bailouts occurred in 2008 of these big, too big to fail banks, since that time they have employed a number of what they're now calling quantitative easing steps. In other words, they're simply running the printing press to bring these banks back into balance. Now, at that time, in 2008, when this was first being floated, financial experts immediately began to talk, well, this is going to produce hyperinflation, you know, within a very short time.
Yeah.
The problem is those first predictions of hyperinflation didn't occur. They still haven't.
Oh my gosh.
They may yet, but my problem here is they were predicting it to have happened by now.
Yeah.
And it hasn't. Now, this means, this is just like an electrical circuit. This means you're putting a lot of electricity into a circuit and it's disappearing.
Yeah.
It's being bled off the circuit somewhere.
Yeah.
Now, my guess is that part of this vast amount of quantitative easing is directly tied to this huge hidden system of finance. And why do I say that? If you stop and look at the amount of money just in the bearer bonds scandals, Georgianne, we've had the Japanese bearer bond scandal, which amounted to a mere $134.5 billion, with a B. We had the Spanish bearer bond scandal that amounted to a whopping $2 trillion. You know, that's a sizable percentage of the American gross domestic product.
Right.
The Italian bearer bond scandal of last year amounted to a whopping $6 trillion.
Yeah.
So you total it all up, and we're dealing with almost $8 trillion.
Oh,
that's almost half of the American gross domestic product.
Sure.
Now, here's the whopper, Georgianne. When you look at these bearer bond scandals, these bonds that are supposedly all counterfeit, and I want your listeners to file this in the back of their brain, these bonds are all supposed to be, number one, gold-backed,
yeah,
and number two, they're dated 1934.
Oh.
Okay, in other words, they've been post-dated.
Yeah.
And the American government consistently denies that any of these things are real.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here's my problem, Georgianne, the first of several problems.
Yes.
Okay, number one. These bonds in the Spanish and Italian case were enclosed in strong boxes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean strong boxes. I put pictures of these things in the book, all right?
Yes.
These strong boxes are Federal Reserve strong boxes from Dallas, Atlanta, and Chicago.
Oh,
all right?
My goodness.
These are strong boxes.
Yeah.
And the bonds are fake. In one instance, they were also accompanied by several tens of millions of dollars of $100,000 bills, you know, which is a real existing American currency.
Yeah.
It's just not in general circulation.
Right.
It's a bill that was used by Federal Reserve banks to circulate gold certificates between them,
mm-hmm.
all right, to manage the physical transfer of gold without the physical transfer of gold. Okay.
Yeah.
So we have that little problem. Okay.
Oh, boy.
So you've got these strong boxes in which all these gold-backed bearer bonds are found.
Yeah.
So in other words, if we're to believe the government story that these bonds are all fake, that they're all counterfeit, then someone went to all the trouble to counterfeit the boxes.
Oh, my gosh. Jeez.
Okay.
Why am I not surprised?
Why? Now, let's stop and consider this.
Mm-hmm.
If we're dealing with somebody that goes to all the expense and effort to counterfeit $500 million gold-backed bearer bonds and $1 billion gold-backed bearer bonds and to post-date them,
mm-hmm.
all right, would they, first of all, counterfeit bills that don't exist? If you're an average counterfeiter, do you counterfeit, let's say, a $7 bill?
No.
Why not?
It, because there's none in circulation.
Bingo!
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Bingo. So the next thing that we're told is, okay, well, they're doing that because what they're really doing is they're saying, well, these counterfeit bonds are the way these con artists scam wealthy people that are their targets because they say it's part of a hidden system of finance.
Yeah.
Okay. Here's the problem. Let's say you're discounting one of your $1 billion gold-backed bearer bonds to 10% of its face value. In other words, you find a wealthy sucker, okay, with $100 million to drop,
oh, boy.
Okay, to buy a discounted $1 billion gold-backed bearer bond,
oh,
right?
My gosh.
Now, I don't know about you, Georgianne, but the last time I looked at people with $100 million to burn.
There's not a lot of them.
Number one, there's not very many of them.
Right.
And number two, not very many of them are stupid enough to buy a $1 billion gold-backed bearer bond at a 90% discount. You know, in other words, the whole thing that we're being told by the government is, you know, that these are counterfeit or the playthings of really careful and really confident confidence men.
Yeah.
That this whole story makes no sense.
Well, Obama, RT came out with a story yesterday, I believe, that Obama wants to print $1 trillion gold coins.
Yes, I know that.
Oh, geez.
I know that. I saw that story, and you know, I want to blog about it. But you're raising the point here.
Uh-huh.
you don't counterfeit or even try to scam the wealthy.
Yeah.
Unless this system really exists.
Good point.
So in other words, you go back to the basic principle. You don't counterfeit something that doesn't exist.
Right.
The very fact that you're counterfeiting, even if these things are counterfeit, in other words,
yeah,
is an indicator that there is a real system on which they're based.
Oh, brother.
So, in other words, we go back to the period of World War II.
Yeah.
And what's going on after the war is you've got all of this bullion being moved into Western banks that comes from Axis plunder.
Yes.
So there's hint number one that something massive is afoot, because you can't get your hands on that stuff, at least not all of it, without the complicity of the very people you just got done defeating.
Yeah.
This means you're making deals with the devil. And why? Because communism is now the big enemy.
Yeah, well, we have to have a boogeyman.
We have to have a boogeyman.
Yeah.
We have to have a huge political slush fund to fight it and eventually defeat it. And on top of that, we're now confronted with something, some of which I do believe comes from all of these post-war Nazi projects that are, you know, still going on down there in Argentina, being funded by all that Nazi loot.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, my gosh.
And let's remember, you know, who's the director of World War II intelligence for the United States of America for the Latin American theater?
Hmm.
Who?
For the United States
in Latin America. America. Yeah. Who's the director of American intelligence in Latin America during World War II and shortly thereafter?
Oh, brother.
Who?
I'm not sure.
Joseph. Nelson Rockefeller.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
Are we connecting some dots now?
Yes.
So you've got a huge system of hidden finance. This is my argument in a nutshell. That system is signaled by these bearer bonds scandals. That's why the American government has to deny that they represent anything real, because that hidden system of finance, and again, I'm not presenting anywhere close to the evidence that I'm presenting in the book,
yeah,
but that hidden system of finance has to be denied.
Yeah.
Because it's a national security issue.
Well, everything is a national security issue.
Well, hang on. But in this case, this hidden system of finance has been used to foment covert operations beginning in Europe with the 1948 Italian elections. There's your role of the Vatican.
Yeah.
It has been used to foment almost all covert operations in Europe since then, the kidnapping of Aldo Moro, the Oktoberfest bombing in Germany. These are all connected to NATO intelligence units and a huge political slush fund.
Yeah.
You see? So in other words, this stuff has been used to fund all this activity on
yeah.
the one hand, and on the other hand, it is so huge. I mean, stop and consider. Are we looking at $8 trillion worth since the end of World War II? Are we really looking at $8 trillion worth of covert ops? No. So in other words, that amount of money went to something else as well.
Well, there was a hearing on Capitol Hill, and they asked this woman what happened to, I think it was $8 trillion,
uh-huh.
that went missing from uh-huh. the Pentagon Fund.
Uh-huh.
And she said, I don't know. I can't tell you.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you're raising a very good point here, because what you're dealing with in cases like that, with missing money, there I think you're dealing with the black budget directly.
Uh-huh.
All right? You see what I'm saying?
Yes.
What I'm saying with this hidden system of finance is you're not even dealing with the black budget.
Oh.
It's even more hidden than that.
Oh, boy.
Because, first of all, it's based on this international cooperation.
Yeah.
ultimately, between Western bankers and the post-war Axis elites, the Nazis in Europe and the Imperial Japanese in Japan, all right? You're looking at something that is deeply, deeply hidden. But because it's so huge and involves the central banks and prime banks of the West, it has to be kept hidden. If the amount of fraud in the system were ever exposed, not only would you have an economic collapse, you'd have, and this is a key important point, you'd have a military collapse.
Oh, brother.
Because this, again, this money has been used. You consider the amounts, Georgianne, just consider the amounts of money.
Yes.
What you have involved here is an amount of money that far exceeds any covert operations, the sum total of covert operations since World War II would require. You know, we're in trillions of dollars here. This can buy you an awful lot of leverage if you're trying to set up a global government. It's enough money to stake out claims on the moon. It's enough money. You see what I'm saying here? This is enough money to leverage an awful lot of secret activity, including setting up private space structures. You know, they're talking about the privatization of space right now. Well, get a clue, folks. Why are they talking about that? Because there's mineral resources out there to be had. You can't get to those mineral resources unless you have an adequate technology to do it, and that's not going to happen with chemical rockets, I'm sorry.
You're not kidding.
You have to have a totally different technology.
That's right.
There's your secret space program.
Oh my God.
So in other words, this huge system of finance, I'm arguing, is intimately connected. It's hugely connected not only to post-war, Cold War covert operations, but more importantly, it's the ultimate basis, in my opinion, for the funding of a huge secret technology base, for a secret space program, for leveraging the corporatization of space. And where you say corporatization, inevitably, of course, that means militarization.
Oh, yeah. Oh, gosh, Joseph. Oh. Well, it seems that what they're doing with the globe and the people on it, number one, they're going to starve out people that are weak and old and not capable of fighting for their food, money to pay for it.
Well, this is another aspect of this whole breakaway civilization theme that I'm hoping eventually to get to, and that's the reason there may be a fourth book. But for now, I'm really concentrated on the implications of this. The hugeness of what these bearer bond scandals are really saying. You don't go to all this effort to counterfeit something that no one's going to buy.
Right.
Or that no one is going to part with. You know, the whole point of counterfeiting is that you take your counterfeit product to the store, you make a small purchase and get real money in exchange for it.
Yeah.
You know, so in other words, to counterfeit on that level for that amount of money implies that you have to, number one, make sure your counterfeit product is good enough that people are going to accept it. And that means there's a real product that it's based on. And this is why there's, this is why I think that these bearer bond stories are so significant. They are a huge clue to a hidden system of finance. And if there's a hidden system of finance, you've got a breakaway civilization.
Well, Joseph, my question is, okay, we've got all this money, and we've got a place on the planet where we can build stuff. Where do we go to get the parts? where do we call up,
sure.
U.S. Auto Supply to get
to get our phasers,
struts, and
our warp drives.
Yeah, I mean, how did we do this?
Okay, it's very, very simple, Georgianne. It's really so colossally simple. And I actually spent time in the book talking about that issue.
Oh, all right? Good.
it's very, very easy. You simply compartmentalize. In other words, let's say you've got this team over here in John Doe's garage putting together the, you know, I'm using Star Trek terminology here, putting together the dilithium crystals for your warp drive chamber, okay?
Oh, brother.
Right? Say they're doing that.
Yeah.
All right. They know enough to know that they're playing around with dilithium crystals, all right?
Yeah.
So they draw up their plans and send it off to their manager, and the manager is the one that actually places the contract for a particular piece of equipment. But they have no idea why they're designing a dilithium crystal chamber.
Yeah.
You know, they're just told to do it.
Oh, dear.
So in other words, you do it the same way that you do in any black project.
Mm-hmm.
You farm out the orders for parts to different companies. And they'll, you know, you give them the specifications, they draw it up, they produce your part, they send it to you. Then they, you know, as far as they're concerned, it's a part that so-and-so asked them to do and paid a lot of money for, and we're done with it. We have no idea what they're going to use it for, you know.
Yeah.
We just built them their part. This is exactly the way that classified programs work. And this is exactly, you know, the reason we were able to keep the A-bomb a secret is that, you know, companies were producing these things, you know, beryllium shields for neutron bombardment in the implosion device of an A-bomb.
Yeah.
But as far as Company A is concerned, all they're getting is for an unusual order, to be sure, for a highly polished piece of round beryllium.
Yeah.
They don't know what it's going to be used for.
You know, the workers at the test site in Las Vegas brought a lawsuit for beryllium poisoning.
Yeah. Well, that doesn't surprise me. But my point here, you know, to stay with the main point,
mm-hmm.
is you keep things compartmentalized, and it's very, very easy to keep secrets. There are very, very few people at the top that coordinate all of this that would know actually ultimately what all of these things are for. But here's the other point: there has to be someone who does.
Yeah.
There has to be someone who sees the full blueprint.
Yes.
Okay.
That's true.
Now, the way you keep that part of it secret is, you know, the usual threats.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, the usual threats.
Well, you mention in your book a catalog of created crises.
Uh-huh.
What are they, and what do you mean by that?
Oh, boy. That goes directly to all of those Cold War covert operations I was talking about. The crisis, for example, in 1948 in Italy, supposedly a crisis where they were very concerned that the communists might take power in Italy, and, you know, that would break the North American Treaty Organization, NATO, you know, by losing a significant European power. So what they did is they ran a covert operation with the Vatican, funneling CIA money into Italy via the Vatican Bank into Italy for the purpose of maintaining a Christian democratic government there.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Other crises would be the Mossadegh crisis, you know, the covert operation that overthrew him in Iran and installed the Shah.
Yeah.
All of these things are, if you look at them, all of these things are covert operations that were funded via this mechanism of a hidden system of finance.
Oh, boy.
Now, this, in other words, you're looking at operations that had no connection to the so-called black budget.
Yeah.
These weren't even on the black budget.
Mm.
So, to put it differently, rather than looking at a catalog of crises, let's remember something very significant that began to happen, that we saw happening in the 1980s, We had the collapse of the Nugan Hand Bank in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
We had later on the infamous BCCI scandal.
Yes.
And the collapse of that bank. Then we had the savings and loan scandal in this country, you know, the Keating Five that was intimately connected to a certain family that begins with B.
Yeah.
The bottom line with each of these things, Georgianne, and this is why I keep telling people they have to quit thinking in terms of the all-powerful, all-competent international bankers.
Yeah.
Because they have a problem. Here's the problem. The intelligence agencies themselves got directly involved in banking. You follow me?
Yeah.
You look at BCCI, scratch and sniff long enough, and you're going to find Clark Clifford.
Yeah.
When you scratch and sniff long enough, you're going to find CIA.
Oh, boy.
The same thing with Nugan Hand. In other words, these banks were literally banks that were fronts.
Yeah.
Now, there's another problem in these created crises. There, we know that we're dealing with a hidden system of finance by a very significant episode that I talk about in the book.
Yes.
During World War II, right at the very beginning of it, in fact, the SS inside of Nazi Germany presented an idea to Reinhard Heydrich, all right?
Mm-hmm.
The idea was to counterfeit British pound notes.
Oh, dear.
In other words, to make Britain finance the Nazi war effort.
Oh, dear.
You know, you don't get more devious than that. So they took the idea to Heydrich, and Heydrich approved the plan. But he made it clear in his top secret directive. He called it unauthorized production. And those terms are very revealing.
Yeah.
Because what he's talking about is not just counterfeiting. He's talking about making, quite literally, English banknotes without the authorization of the Bank of England. In other words, he's talking about counterfeits indistinguishable from the real item.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
And doing it, here's the other part of the equation, production.
That's
doing it on an industrial scale.
Boy, that's sweet.
Yeah, isn't it, though? Isn't it, though?
Oh.
Now, you know, they called this Operation Bernhardt after the SS officer that was running it, all right?
Oh, dear.
Yeah, and, you know, they scoured the concentration camps for Europe's best counterfeiters and gave them special privileges and put them to work churning out millions, millions of pounds sterling notes, all
oh,
right?
Oh, dear. Oh.
And to make sure that they were good enough, they tested, you know, their product by sending agents to Switzerland
oh.
with counterfeited letters from the Reichsbank.
Oh, my gosh.
On counterfeit Reichsbank stationery. Oh. You know, this is the SS doing all of this. Sent Reichsbank so-called representatives to Switzerland since, you know, the Swiss banks were competent enough to determine if they were dealing with counterfeit English banknotes or not. And they couldn't tell.
Mm.
The product was so good, Georgianne, that it's, and the this is the conservative estimate, that by the end of World War II, approximately 40% of all circulating English pound notes were counterfeit by the Nazis. Now,
well,
consider what that means. That means 50%, nearly half of all circulating British banknotes at the end of World War II were counterfeit.
Those dirty buggers. Oh.
Now, you know, that takes great big brass ones.
Yes, it does.
You know,
And
the sad thing is that these notes were so good, the Bank of England simply had to redesign their currency.
Oh, my gosh.
Completely redesign it.
Oh.
and had to honor the counterfeits.
Oh my God.
If you're wondering why we had that sudden drop after World War II in the value of the British pound, there you are.
Oh, my goodness.
Now, let's pause and reflect on the implications of this because, you know, I'm not saying that the Nazis are running all of these bearer bond scandals. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that this operation and the care with which the Germans reverse engineered the process of printing British pounds is you know that was a technique that was studied. It was a technique that was changed. It was utilized and tweaked by their American counterparts after the war.
Oh, why am I not surprised?
And these people doing this tweaking, of course, are all connected to the circle of people surrounding the creation of the CIA.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, and I'm talking here particularly of the Dulles brothers. I'm talking of Frank Wisner.
Oh.
I'm talking about Ed Lansdale.
Oh.
All of these people involved in these post-war covert operations. Well, the other thing that Operation Bernhardt taught them is it's absolutely vital to get your hands on the printing plates for all of this stuff.
Oh.
Okay? And
yikes.
If you're wondering why the bearer bonds look peculiarly like circulating issues of American paper money, there you go.
Bush gave Iraq plates, printing plates.
Okay. Let's stop right there.
Okay.
You don't even have to do that. You can go back to periods right after, during World War II and shortly thereafter, where peculiarly plates were given away or went missing.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this right there, as far as I'm concerned, is the beginning of this hidden system of finance, because let me show you how insidious this system really was.
Okay.
And is, all right?
I'm on the edge of my chair.
Okay. Now remember, the goal here is we've got to get enough money to reverse engineer or at least build a flying saucer that can emulate all of this stuff flying around in our skies, all right? And that's going to be a heck of a lot of money.
Yes.
All right? So we're going to have to raise a lot of money.
Oh, boy.
We're going to have to raise so much money, in fact, that we're probably never going to be able to repay it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sounds familiar.
With me so far?
Yes.
All right. Now, it just so happens that old Chiang Kai-shek over here in Nationalist China is sitting on top of a huge pile of gold. All right?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm kind of shortening the story a bit here. And at the end of World War II, it just so happens that, you know, good old Hirohito is sitting on top of a just mind-boggling amount of bullion.
Oh,
and only he and the imperial family really knows where they hid it all.
Oh, my gosh.
Well, we do know that he hid some of it in, guess where, the Vatican Bank.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. And the rest he buried around the Philippines. So think Ferdinand Marcos here for a little bit.
Yeah.
All right. Now, we know that Hirohito's sitting on top of a lot of this. And if we can just persuade His Imperial Majesty that we're really not so bad, sorry about dropping those two A-bombs on your cities, but, you know, if we can just persuade Your Imperial Majesty, you know, we're not going to get rid of you, you can still be emperor and all this stuff, keep your money, all this good stuff, just let us have some of it.
Yes, okay. Some of it.
All right. Well, what you do is you say, okay, turn over to us $500 million worth of gold bullion for safekeeping.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
What we'll do is we'll issue, and since we're keeping all of this secret and off the books, mm-hmm. we're not going to issue you U.S. Treasury bonds. We're going to issue you Federal Reserve bonds. Now, here's part of the story, folks. These bearer bond scandals, if you look hard enough, these are all Federal Reserve bonds. They're not U.S. Treasury bonds.
Yeah.
Okay?
Oh, boy.
Now, that's the clue right away that something's going on. Because, first of all, everybody knows that, so supposedly, that the Federal Reserve doesn't issue U.S. securities.
Yeah.
The U.S. Treasury does.
Yeah.
The Federal Reserve buys them and in return gives the federal government so much Federal Reserve notes mm-hmm. for the U.S. Treasury bonds.
Yeah.
Which the Federal Reserve then turns around and sells, okay?
Uh-huh.
So in other words, the Federal Reserve private bank does not itself issue bonds.
Yeah.
Except in every case we have of these bearer bond scandals, they are Federal Reserve bonds. So again, the question to bear in mind is, do you counterfeit something that doesn't exist?
Uh-huh.
So in other words, what they did when they suckered Chiang Kai-shek out of his gold was they gave him Federal Reserve bonds.
Oh, dear.
And this is going to be a secret, Chiang.
Yeah.
Okay. Now notice what this gives them the ability to do. Should the bearer of those bearer bonds ever present them for redemption?
Mm-hmm.
If they've played along, then they might be redeemed.
Oh, boy.
Probably at a discount.
Oh.
If they haven't played along, oh, we're sorry. Those bonds are counterfeit.
Uh-huh.
You lose everything.
Oh, dear.
You see what's going on here?
Yeah.
Now, if you don't...
It's an extortion scheme.
It's an extortion scheme. Yeah, bingo. It's fraud on a massive scale,
Georgian. Yeah.
It's fraud on a massive... Now, since the gold itself... Since the gold itself is now secret, what can you do with that? Well, golly. The first thing you can do is melt it all down, recast it, and stamp it with different numbers. And if you do that, that means you've just rehypothecated that gold and reassigned it to a different owner.
Oh, my God.
And, by the way, we can do that over and over and over.
Yes. A thousand times.
Bingo.
Gee. Mm-hmm. Oh, my God, Joseph.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. Now, this, I think, Georgian, is what this whole system was what allowed the creation of this breakaway civilization and allowed it to, therefore, develop probably technologies that we can scarcely guess at.
Yeah.
And keep it entirely off the books. This is beyond black budget.
Mm.
Because the amounts of money are significant enough that it would be the kind of amount of money that you would need to develop technologies like that.
Oh, my God.
And, you know, you have a little pocket change left over to fund the odd covert operation, you know, here and there for $100 million here, $10 million there. You know?
Oh, gee.
That's a drop in the bucket when you're dealing with trillions of dollars.
Oh.
And this is, I think, Georgian, the real reason that there have been these persistent allegations that Dr. Hjalmar Schacht, when he was, you know, under trial at the Nuremberg trials, got off so lightly, because there have been persisting rumors that he literally blackmailed the Western bankers.
Probably.
Well, you know, I suspect that this has something to do with it, because as president of the Reichsbank, he had to have been aware of the massive rehypothecation taking place and what it was really ultimately going, the purpose of it was going for.
Oh.
So I think, you know, I think we're dealing with a huge story here that may be the hidden story behind why the banks now are so nervous, because part of that nervousness is explained by the fact that not all of them are in on this system.
Yeah.
And those that are perhaps beginning to wake up and realize they're no longer calling the shots. The intelligence agencies are.
Yeah. Yeah.
The intelligence agencies have the technology to reproduce and counterfeit the bank's own securities.
Oh, brother.
You see?
Oh. Oh, my gosh. Oh, Joseph.
Yeah. It's really getting out of hand.
Oh. Oh.
You know, and for all those gold bugs out there, for all of you that think the answer to all this is going back to bullion, you know, as a backing, here's the problem. How much is in existence?
Yeah, we don't know.
We don't know. If you are saying there's, let's say, 200,000 metric tons of gold bullion in existence and are planning to base a world currency on or economic system on that, and all of a sudden you learn that there's five times that amount in existence, what happens to the value of gold?
It goes down.
It plummets. It doesn't go down.
Gee. Well, a fellow that I talked to about gold said that they're going to make a gold bubble, and
sure,
it's going to burst big time.
Oh yeah, that's you know, I don't offer opinions on financial things, but everybody's saying buy gold. No, you know, I am very skeptical. Simply because of what I found in the basis of my research, you've got hugely obfuscated numbers of gold.
Right,
and that's the problem. The numbers themselves are all out of whack.
Yeah, for sure.
Oh. And again, it's all because of this huge hidden system of finance that has been in place since the end of World War II. And folks, if you take anything away from this talk about this book, remember this. It's not just the central banks that you're looking at involved in this activity. It's the intelligence agencies, ultimately.
Yeah. And not every intelligence agent would know or be aware
of course
of this.
No.
It would be a select few.
Right. It would be a very select few. And, you know, you're dealing, when I say breakaway civilization, you are literally dealing with hidden networks within networks.
Networks, yeah.
Yeah. You're dealing with something hugely hidden. And, you know, the only structure I can really compare what you're looking at to is the mafia. You know, they can all gather like mafia dons around their green-topped tables and smoke cigars and sip brandy.
Yeah.
And be very nice to each other. And then go out from the meeting and order their lieutenants to murder each other. You know,
yeah.
This is the way these people are.
Yep.
Just because there's a thing called the mafia doesn't mean there isn't factional infighting.
That's right.
And that's the key here.
Well, oh, Joseph, that's breathtaking stuff.
This is huge.
Oh, God. Well, that brings us to technologies.
Uh-huh.
Of plausibility,
uh-huh,
deniable mass destruction.
Uh-huh.
The total culture of total power and control,
uh-huh,
and the doctrine of full spectrum dominance.
Dominance, right.
Weaponizing planet Earth.
Yeah.
What do you mean by that?
By all of that?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Full spectrum dominance is an actual name, the technical name given to the military doctrine, the current military doctrine of the United States.
Oh.
And basically all it means is that the United States must be and possess the means of dominance in every conceivable field.
Oh.
From the battlefield to control of information, you know, all of it, everything.
Oh.
So in other words, you're dealing with what I'm calling the culture of total power.
Yeah.
Now, remember, this is the matrix of the breakaway civilization, which I don't think is merely an American phenomenon, but I think it has an American core.
Yeah.
Just as I think it has very powerful, very influential fascist elements.
Oh, yeah.
Very powerful, very influential connections to the mafia, to in other words, the international criminal underground. It has very, very powerful and influential Asian elements, principally Japanese. All right?
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, the breakaway civilization in itself is international, but it has a solidly American core.
Yeah.
And it's out of that culture of full-spectrum dominance that this breakaway group's thinking is formed. Well, you see that reflected, I think, in the emergence of technologies that are plausible, or pardon me, are capable of plausible deniability. Why? Let's go back to that all-important Cold War context for all of this. The reason you engage in covert operations
mm-hmm.
is that they give you the ability to deny direct involvement. In other words, plausible deniability.
Yeah.
When the Italian elections in 1948 happened, you know, when they were doctored and the whole CIA covert operation was run, well, it was being run principally by the Italians themselves
mm-hmm.
with the Vatican in the background and CIA money. So even though the ultimate source of all of this is in the United States, the cutouts are Italian.
Mm.
See?
Yeah.
So you've got plausible deniability. When Mossadegh is overthrown, who do you have on the ground doing it? Well, you've got a bunch of these post-war Nazis, plausible deniability.
Yeah.
When Gamal Abdel Nasser overthrows King Farouk, well, who's ultimately in the background? Well, it's the CIA. But who's on the ground in Egypt doing this and helping Nasser do it? It's all those Nazis. Plausible deniability.
Yeah.
See? So in other words, if you take that same culture and apply it to the development of technology,
yes.
then what you have are technologies that can give you plausible deniability. In other words, technologies that can manipulate the weather, cause hurricanes, cause tornadoes, cause earthquakes, cause droughts,
cause
floods, cause tsunamis. You see, there's your plausible deniability. It wasn't us. It was an act of God.
Yeah.
You see.
Yeah.
So I call these emulational technologies
mm-hmm.
Because they emulate acts of nature or acts of God.
Yeah.
And thus give you the ultimate cloak for direct warfare.
I wonder how angry the world would be if everybody actually knew that a lot of these disastrous storms
mm-hmm.
are created.
Mm-hmm. I think they'd be very angry. But
yeah.
you see, the problem here is is the breakaway civilization has factions.
Yeah.
So in other words, you have at the very high level, you have to have some degree of international cooperation, because let's remember what the real issue is at the very center and the most hidden layer of all of this. It's the UFO.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Okay. The reason why you have to have international cooperation, George Ann, at an extremely high and very secret level, is that when UFOs are flying around, let's say, Ellsworth Air Force Base in South Dakota,
mm-hmm.
and switching on and switching off your ICBMs.
Oh, yeah. yeah.
Or reprogramming the targeting information in them.
Oh, boy.
Or beginning launch sequence countdowns.
Yeah.
And they're doing the same thing in the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
Don't you think that this would require an American response of, oh, my God, you know, somebody else can launch all of our missiles?
Yeah.
We'd better make sure that, you know, the Russians know about this.
Yeah.
And do you think the Russians would be interested? You betcha.
Yeah.
Do you think they would have a similar response? You betcha. Why? Because what if one of these UFO thingies actually manages to launch a missile?
Oh, brother. Oh.
You see, they're going to cooperate and they're going to conference with each other about these types of issues. There's just no doubt in my mind that they're going to do that. But it's going to be at an extremely secret level.
Oh, yeah.
Now, if the core issue here is how are we going to deal with all of that, then put the idea of plausible deniable technologies into that context.
Mm.
The game just got very complicated.
Oh, yeah.
Because you see, what this means is you may want to develop technologies like the UFO to fool a human enemy.
Yes.
Or, and that's entirely possible. You see, you notice I'm leaving the word extraterrestrial out of the conversation.
Yeah, I know.
I'm concerned with the phenomenon here and what it means. But let's say you have determined, all right, okay, the Roswell thing was a bunch of Germans flying around. We don't know where they're from.
Mm-hmm.
But we know that up here in Malmstrom Air Force Base, this wasn't German.
Right.
Let's just say for the sake of argument that you've determined that not all of this activity is somebody in this breakaway civilization, some faction with access to this technology. Let's say you've made the determination
mm-hmm.
that some of it's not coming from here.
Oh, boy.
Okay.
Yeah.
How do you interact with that?
Uh-huh.
How do you convince that whoever is behind it, don't tinker or don't play around with us too much?
Oh, boy.
You have to, in other words, you're in a game of poker here. You have to either have some high cards or play a very convincing bluff.
Oh, yeah.
In other words, you're going to have technologies of emulation that can not only convince a human potential enemy,
right,
but somebody else.
Oh, that's ominous, Joseph.
It's very ominous.
Oh, my God.
And again, the bottom line here is that's going to require a huge financial matrix to pull all of this off.
Wow.
Without tipping off the population of the world. So, in other words, yeah, you can't simply sit there and raise taxes forever.
Yeah.
You've got to come up with a system of leveraging the existing financial system to an enormous degree. And the only way you can do that is by massive fraud.
Yes. Yep. Oh, my God.
Yep.
Oh.
This is staggering stuff.
Yes, it is. Absolutely staggering. Good grief. Oh.
Yeah, this is huge stuff. This is why it's taking me so long, you know, and to be honest, I think this is also why Mr. Dolan is approaching the subject with a similar caution, because when you start thinking in these terms, arguing that case becomes very difficult.
Yeah.
So, you know, the title of this book is Covert Wars and Breakaway Civilizations, Celestial Psyops, because that's really ultimately here what the game is. It's a celestial psyop. You're in a game of poker with whoever.
Mm-hmm.
And that poker game includes some very powerful players here on Earth, some of whom are not even, you know, nations. You know,
yeah.
My whole idea of the Nazi International. Well,
right.
You've got a similar capability with the Japanese Yakuza. You know, that's another part of this story I don't even get into.
Yeah. Not
except
yet.
I do briefly in this book a bit, but you know, you've got a similar entity in pre-war Japan.
Yes.
That survives the war.
Yeah.
And they have access to enormous funding. The Japanese, as we all know, are extremely capable engineers and scientists. So, you know, you've got the possibility of a number of nations here on Earth with their own black projects. You've got this huge hidden system of finance with its own black projects, and probably each national faction within it controlling some aspects of it. And then interjected into all of this situation, you have the UFO.
Wow.
Wow.
Oh.
Yeah. So these people, you know, I don't have any love lost for the elite, but on the other hand, when you put yourself into the situation that they were in at the end of World War II, they have, at least in the West's case thus far, been able to deal with all of this with remarkable efficiency.
Oh, Joseph. Well, you've mentioned that their factions are fighting each other. What are they fighting over?
I think at this stage now, Georgianne, they are fighting over three things. The first is over the control of information and therefore the direction of the program.
Mm-hmm.
All right. In other words, I think part of this is, in a certain sense, a fight over scheduling.
Oh.
How fast do they move?
Yeah.
I think, as I said before, they're under some sort of external pressure. I don't know what it is. No one really does, but everybody senses it.
Yeah.
So the first thing they're fighting for is control of information, therefore the agenda. The second thing they're fighting for is control of this hidden system of finance. Mm-hmm. Somebody is making a huge play, either to control it or expose it.
Oh, my.
Now, there's only a very few players that could expose it, and that's the people that helped set it up, the Chinese, the Japanese, the Nazis, the European fascists, if you will, and the Anglo-American financial elite. That's it.
Mm.
Now, I think the Russians know about it,
but
they didn't help set it up. But I'm positive they know about it.
Oh.
So you've got major factional infighting for control of this system. You know, I blogged very recently about the Vatican's calls for a global currency, a global central bank, and a global, quote-unquote, moral authority.
Oh, yeah.
Well, you know, if you want to put your faith and trust in a moral authority that's roasted people alive in its past for, you know...
That's for, right.
For this or that and the other, then, you know, God help you.
Mm-hmm.
I make no bones about this. But the fact that you have that is an indicator that there are people, in my mind, there are people in Europe that don't want to be beholden anymore to the American core in that financial system. You know, the World Bank, BIS, International Monetary Fund, all of these things are creations of this post-war American financial elite.
Right.
And it's all part of this huge system, including this hidden financial system that was set up at the end of World War II. So I think you're seeing signs that there are cracks within that structure. But I also think that you're seeing signs that the victims of that structure, which principally have been the Chinese, I mean, when you stop and consider the amount of wealth that was literally looted from that country during World War II, I think that you're seeing some blowback from the victims. Okay.
Well, that's reasonable.
Right.
I mean, good grief.
And the third thing, obviously, that they're fighting for is this is perhaps the most disturbing of them all. They're fighting for control of this technology.
Oh, dear.
You know, you have Ben Rich, and I pointed this out in Saucer, Swastikas, and Psyops, the first book in this little series, and then again in this particular book.
Yeah.
When you have the former head of Lockheed's Skunk Works.
Yeah.
Okay, in other words, a man who was in the eye of the storm of black projects.
Yes.
When you have this man, after his retirement,
Ben Rich,
saying things like, "We have the technology to take E.T. home."
Yeah.
we have things decades in advance of anything that even public physics can dream of.
Yeah.
We have, we found an error in the equations, and now we can take E.T. home.
Oh,
you know,
right.
when you have a man like this saying that,
yeah,
you want to know where all this money went? There it is.
Oh, gee.
When you have Gary McKinnon in the United Kingdom, and I don't even talk about him in this particular book. I'm planning to eventually.
Yeah.
But when you have Gary McKinnon in the United Kingdom hacking into NASA computers and finding, according to him, evidence of a hidden space fleet,
yeah,
you know, with transfers, where's all this money going?
Oh, boy.
Well, could we be trading with somebody?
Off-worlders?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You see where all of this is going?
Yeah.
If you look at things in this way, then some of this is for control of the technology.
Yeah.
And I think part of that, the fear, again, is proliferation here on Earth.
Well, surely an established off-world society that are not necessarily of our species,
mm-hmm.
or if they are, not born and raised here,
mm-hmm.
What good would money do them?
Trade. Planet Earth, when you get right down to it, is at least in this neck of the celestial woods, is very unique.
Mm-hmm.
It's resource rich.
Yeah.
And for that matter, the solar system is. So if you have a bunch of scrappy, you know, apes on this planet,
yeah,
that just happen to possess thermonuclear weapons, which, you know, we know. You know, UFO activity began to spike in terms of its historical manifestations right around the end of World War II.
Yeah.
And, you know, ufologists have always speculated, and I believe they're absolutely right, that the reason why is if there is somebody else monitoring us, it was because we were approaching the acquisition of nuclear power.
Uh-huh.
Not that that's so significant in and of itself, but that's the gateway technology,
yeah,
to the technology that gets you to the stars.
Oh, boy.
Besides, you know, being a technology that gives you some horrendously powerful weapons.
Well, what I'm thinking of, Joseph, the off-worlders, I'm sure they don't have a Arby's, they don't have...
No, but we have resources. We have resources. They may have things, again, if we're dealing with off-worlders, we may not even be dealing with off-worlders. We may be dealing with sub-worlders or sub-oceanic worlders or something, you know.
Yeah.
But they may have access to resources, and the only way that you trade resources is through a medium of exchange. I mean, this is just the bottom line.
Well, what good would money do then?
They can buy resources, hon.
From
what
who?
Good does, what, from us. That's the whole point here.
Okay.
Think of it as being no different than trade between two nations here on Earth.
Okay.
You know, they're going to have some medium of exchange. Presumably they have each their own currency, and they conduct trade in it.
Okay.
You follow me?
Yeah.
And, you know, there's all the evidence in the world that there was trade being conducted between Europe and North America prior to Columbus coming here.
Yeah.
All right. So there is some way that this is all being done, if it's in fact being done. The principal thing I'm trying to drive at here is that this money is going to produce the technology that makes it possible.
Oh.
And it's going to produce the technology that allows them to play that bluff poker game.
Mm.
That to me is the key part here.
Okay.
That, to me, is the key part.
Well, to take this a step further,
mm-hmm.
there's alleged to be a trench that goes all the way around the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And
under the ocean.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And they're talking about a massive, massive earthquake
mm-hmm.
involving that trench.
Mm-hmm.
Who would be stupid enough to set something like that off?
Well, I cannot even, for these people, imagine any of them stupid enough to try and do anything like that. Unless they plan to get off of this planet.
Yeah.
And just get rid of the rest of us. I can imagine a potential enemy.
Yes.
Of planet Earth. Taking advantage of a planetary instability, if that is indeed what that trench represents.
Yeah.
And using it to destroy the Earth. After all, we've got all of those ancient texts,
mm-hmm.
You know, that in my opinion, at least, are talking about blowing up planets. All right.
Yeah.
And the classical means of any form of geophysical warfare is to rely upon inherent structural instabilities. In other words, you know, tectonic plates. Instabilities in weather systems and so on. You simply amplify those instabilities until they crack.
Oh, brother.
Yeah.
Well,
in other words, I hope you understood what I just gave you there. That's an important clue. Because what it means is you don't have to reach Class 1 civilization status in terms of your energy requirements in order to be able to pull off Class 1 civilization effects.
Oh, boy.
You can still be a Class 0 civilization, as we are, but you can still engineer a technology to pull off a planetary system-wide manipulation. Yeah,
yeah.
You betcha. We've got that now.
Oh.
In fact, I think, as I hint in that book, I think that some of these technologies are capable of Class 2 civilization effects.
Mm.
In other words, that they can also manipulate solar effects.
Yes, that was my next question.
Yeah.
Could they create a massive EMP or CME?
Yeah, I think the potential. I have a white paper in the members area of my website that talks about that. I don't want to go into details here, but I do in
okay.
that paper. But yeah, I think the potential exists to do that sort of thing via a kind of resonance effect.
Oh.
Yeah, I think it's possible. It would require an enormous amount of energy.
Yeah.
And it would require some very precise knowledge to engineer those kinds of resonance effects.
Yes.
But the potential's there. The potential is there.
Oh, my God.
We have to remember that those ancient texts that talk about certain gods using entire stars for weapons.
Yeah, yeah.
Are not too far off.
Yeah.
And they're not as far off in our future as we may think they are. Again, you don't have to be a Class 2 civilization, or pardon me, a Class 1 civilization to engineer the effect
right.
of manipulating a planetary system. You can do that through the use of tweaking instabilities in the system.
Mm.
Those are my feral corollaries to Kardashev's classification. Yeah, and this means, you know, why would you be doing something like this? Well, again, I think you have to have the emulational technologies if you're going to be playing poker with a, you know, we talk about geopolitical enemies. We might as well now talk about solar politics.
Yes.
You know, if you're going to be playing those kinds of games with elsewhere, so to speak,
mm-hmm.
then you have to have enough in your hand that you've played to convince whoever is playing on the other side that you may hold higher cards.
Yeah. Oh, boy. Oh, Oh, Joseph.
Uh-huh.
This is very dangerous stuff.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
Oh, my gosh. Good
yes, it
grief.
Is.
Ah. Well,
and, but, you know, we have to look at the other side of this card, Georgianne. Let's put ourselves again in the position of these elites.
Okay.
We know that, for example, the Rockefeller family is keenly interested in UFOs.
Mm-hmm.
Because they've commissioned studies of it.
Mm-hmm.
Lawrence Rockefeller was fascinated with it. Well, why would he be fascinated? Because it's a hobby?
Mm-hmm.
No. Because it represents a potential threat to their power. Pure and simple.
Oh, my gosh.
Pure and simple. So, in other words, these elites are going to be interested in the phenomenon, whether they acknowledge it publicly or not.
Right.
They're going to be interested in the phenomenon because it represents a potential threat to their power.
Oh, boy.
And the only way that they're going to be able to enhance or strengthen their position in the face of that threat is to be able to emulate or reproduce what they see being done.
Yeah.
And if they come to the conclusion that this is a phenomenon under intelligent control, but not human control,
mm-hmm.
and if, furthermore, they have had some contact with it, then they have to convince it that they're dealing with equals.
Oh, boy.
Ugh. Or at least near equals.
Yeah.
This is, yeah, it's
Ooh.
Dangerous. You betcha.
Oh, yes.
You betcha.
Extremely so.
You know, when back in Roswell and the Reich, when I wrote that President Truman had the Air Force shoot down, issued the Air Force a shoot down order of UFOs,
mm-hmm.
my argument then was, and to a certain extent it remains that now, that he wouldn't have issued that order if he thought that he, by doing so, he might get us into an interplanetary war.
Right.
In other words, the threat assessment there, that's lurking in the background, that's implicit in the order itself, is that at that time they had concluded that they weren't dealing with a phenomenon all that much farther advanced than what we were capable of arriving at.
Wow.
And you see what I'm saying?
Yes.
But if at any point they come to the conclusion that they are dealing with a phenomenon vastly superior to human capability. Are they going to try and emulate it? You betcha.
Oh, yeah.
Are they going to try and get some of that technology by any means possible? Yeah, you betcha. Are they going to play a game to convince whoever's behind it not to tangle with them? Absolutely. This is, again, it's very, very dangerous.
Oh, boy, you can say that again.
And I think by the time that you have UFOs flying around ICBM silos and turning them on or off, starting launch sequences, and worse, reprogramming target information.
Oh, God.
I think by that time, it's fairly apparent that even though the Germans and Italians are experimenting with ways to shut down Allied airplane motors from a distance using electromagnetic means, they're not from a distance taking over control of the aircraft and telling it where to fly.
Yeah,
okay.
That's right.
So in other words, you may be thinking you're dealing with some sort of Nazi holdover if they're turning on or off the missiles, but reprogramming them?
Oh, brother.
Okay, starting launch sequences?
Oh, Jesus.
That's a different matter.
If very.
That's a different matter.
Oh, my gosh.
At that point, I think, you have a technological signature there.
Yeah.
In those types of incidents that are right on the cusp of what may potentially be possible to humans by that time if they had a heck of a lot of money behind them, and that's my point, they did, or you're also dealing with a signature that's very, very sophisticated and may not be human at all. That's right on that fuzzy borderline, as far as I'm concerned.
Wow. Oh,
now, that doesn't, you know, again, I'm not saying because of saying that, I'm not saying I'm jumping on board with the extraterrestrial hypothesis.
Right.
Because there are any number of other alternative hypotheses that you also have to consider.
Yes.
But you certainly have to have that one as well.
Yeah.
In your stew of interpretive and analytical possibilities.
Oh. My goodness, Joseph. This stuff is really, truly frightening.
It is. That's why I'm taking time to write my concerns in several books.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we start out with the whole Nazi thing. And I do believe, you know, I'm not changing my thesis one whit. I do believe they survived the war. I believe they continued these technological developments. And I think you have an international fascist group in existence today, and
yeah.
You know that qualifies as most of the Anglo-American oligarchy, because you know, if, listening to them talk, I can't tell much difference between them and fascists anyway.
Yeah,
so, you know,
that's true.
So you know, I'm not changing that, and my point in saucers, swastikas, and psyops was to raise in the context of the UFO the very fact that the whole idea of using technology like this in a psychological operation begins during World War II.
Oh.
The Nazis dream it up.
Yeah.
But once we get that background out of the way and move on to the size and scale of what this technology represents, what the UFO represents, not only financially requiring a huge amount of finance to duplicate, but also what it represents politically, culturally.
Yeah.
You know, this is why I'm taking my time with this.
Oh, Joseph. Well, how does the Vatican play into all of this? I knew that would make you chuckle.
Because there is a whole chapter in the book. In fact, the chapter is actually split into two with an intermission.
Oh, boy.
because the chapter is just very long, you know, and I wanted to, you know, stop the movie and let everybody go to the bathroom, smoke their cigarettes, get their coffee, and, you know, kind of catch their breath before moving along. But,
yeah.
But the point here that is so crucial about the Vatican is, how to put it, if you're going to have a hidden system of finance, at some point this system interfaces with the public one.
Yeah.
And you're going to have a broker, an interface between the two worlds, so to speak, that everybody would accept, number one, as being in on the deal, and number two, as being trustworthy.
Yeah.
And, you know, this goes back to the whole Babylon's Banksters connection.
Right.
To, you know, you are going to use the probity or the aura of it that religion provides you to cloak and authenticate these types of deals. Mm. So, broadly speaking, that's the philosophical reason. Historically speaking, it's because the Vatican after World War II was the international mechanism by which you could funnel all of these covert funds into Europe for covert operations.
Oh, boy.
Okay, that's number two.
Yeah.
Number three is that the Vatican is also, as people now know, involved in another interface, and that was all of those rat line operations getting Nazis to Latin America.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what people don't realize is that the Vatican was also oftentimes the financial conduit for all that Nazi loot.
Oh, brother.
Just go back to what I said earlier tonight.
Mm-hmm.
Hirohito
put
a lot of that loot into the Vatican Bank.
So,
you know, they're dealing with these people.
Yeah.
Okay? And number four.
Oh, boy, there's more.
There's more.
Oh, gee.
Number four is, I put in the book, if none of the other, if none of these other things convince you, then I put into the book an episode where, and I'm not going to tell you who it was, where a very, very famous cardinal archbishop was involved in not only laundering money, but having the mafia literally counterfeit almost $1 billion worth of American corporate securities.
Oh, my gosh.
Okay. And when the individual that was contacted to do this kind of, as you know, imagine you or me sitting in the Vatican in an audience with the Cardinal Archbishop.
Yeah.
And he turns to us and says, I want you to get $950 million worth of counterfeit American corporate securities.
Oh, my gosh.
Now, if you and I were to hear that, we would probably have the same reaction that the individual did. Well, you know, that's fine, but my word, how are you going to get away with such a thing? The Americans will never, you know, they'll never go along with it.
Yeah.
Well, at that point that this individual is talking to this particular cardinal archbishop raised that objection, the cardinal's response was, oh, I hardly think that the Americans are going to accuse the Vatican of forgery.
Oh, dear.
Now, stop and consider all the context of what I've just told you tonight.
Yeah.
Why would he be so confident of that?
Uh-huh.
Because the Vatican acted as the agent for the 1948 elections, acted as the agent for all that Axis loot, and probably also, as a result, also knew about this huge system of hidden finance.
Wow.
Remember when the Japanese bearer bonds story broke?
Yeah.
It was Asia News which broke the story.
Yeah.
Along with Der Spiegel in Germany.
Yes.
Asia News is connected to the Vatican.
Yeah. Oh.
Oh, boy. Yeah, oh, boy. Now, please understand, folks, when we say Vatican Bank here, we're not talking Benedict the 16th. We're talking the bureaucracy in the Vatican that runs it. The popes really are not all that directly involved in the affairs of the Vatican Bank. This is at a different level.
Yeah.
So, you know, at the time that the Vatican Bank first emerged into world news as having all sorts of problems, you know, it was back during the 80s.
Yeah.
And the fellow that at the time was the head of it was actually, guess what, an American bishop by the name of Paul Marcinkus.
Yeah.
And incidentally, he was active at the time that this very famous Cardinal Archbishop was asking for fraudulent securities.
Oh, my God. You're making my hair hurt. Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh, Joseph.
Yeah, it's just, you know, you can't make this stuff up, folks.
No,
you know, this is,
you can't.
This, I keep telling, you know, wake me when the movie's over, you know.
Yeah.
Because this, you know, Hollywood couldn't dream up a plot like this.
Boy, you can say that again.
Timothy Leary, when he was tripping, couldn't dream up a plot like this.
True. Oh, my gosh. Oh. It's astounding. It's staggering. It's beyond the beyond. I mean, my God.
Yeah, it is.
Gee.
It is. But you see, again, the core here that people have to bear in mind, well, why the Vatican? Well, if you're dealing with UFOs, why not?
Yeah.
You know, it is, like it or not, for good or ill, it's the principal spokesman for Western culture.
Yeah.
It helped shape it.
Yep.
You know? So not for nothing do you find the Vatican coming out, as all of this other stuff is swirling on, coming out with the odd statement, oh, yeah, it would be okay to baptize an extraterrestrial.
Yeah.
You know, why not? Okay. Well, you know, putting that into context, folks, that makes me a little nervous.
Yes, it does.
Because I'm because I'm thinking here, Spain. Okay, we arrive in the New World, and we've got all of these quote unquote primitive savages over here. Well, you know, after we get done turning the cannon on them, then we're going to run them through a river and baptize them.
Oh.
You know, when he said that, I'm thinking, oh my word.
Yeah.
Are we, you know, has E.T. now crashed so many flying saucers into planet Earth and we've reverse engineered so many of them that we're now more advanced than E.T.? So we're ready to spread the faith to worlds out there, you know?
Pollute the rest of the galaxy. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, you know, this again, it's just to say such a thing. I mean, really, stop and consider the context historically that this meant in human history and what it meant. It meant conquest.
Yes.
That's what it meant.
Yes.
So again, was that a message?
Probably.
Was that part of the poker game? Mm. You see, once you start down this road, you have to start looking at all these things in a very different light.
Yes. Absolutely. Oh, Joseph, this book is just splendid. I mean,
well, thank you.
The information that you've got laid out, the way you've laid it out, it is critical information, and it is very understandable. My goodness.
Well, I hope so.
Oh, my goodness. Everybody, Joseph has a PayPal button on his website. Please go there and work that PayPal button bare. There's things he needs, like research material, etc., and make it possible, everybody.
Yeah, that's something, and thank you for that, Georgianne. That's something I should mention about this book, the research material. A lot of the research material in this book was online, because with the UFO, you know, you're not dealing with ancient things or, you know, special texts that, you know, that you just can't get.
Yeah.
A lot of it, however, was not online.
Yeah.
I had to dig around for some things that, some old books and stuff, but I'm entering a new phase of research here for the next couple of books, and it's going to be interesting where all this is going.
Yes, I'm sure it is.
Yeah, I am not going to talk about where it's going, but we're getting ready for some big projects. So.
Yeah, I know. Oh, boy. Hold on to your hats, everybody. Oh, my gosh, Joseph. This book is just splendid.
Well, thank
you've
you.
Done a splendid job.
Well, I hope so. Like I say, it's part of a series, so we're not done yet. I kind of leave everybody hanging in this one.
Yeah.
But.
Oh, well, it's fascinating.
Thank you.
So everybody go get it. You've got to get it. And, Joseph, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me back, Georgia.
Oh, anytime, and God bless
and
you.
And work out her PayPal button, folks, too. These... bandwidth isn't cheap.
No, it's not. And thank you, Joseph.
Yeah, I really don't know how you do it, quite frankly. But.
Well, I'm pretty skinny.
I know you are. I know you are.
I don't eat much.
I know that, too.
My dogs eat well, but...
Sparrows eat more than you do.
Oh. That's about true.
Yeah, that's about true.
Lots of coffee.
Lots of coffee.
Yeah. Okay, everybody. God bless everyone out there that's listening and paying attention, because these are very crucial conversations. I don't call them interviews, Joseph. They're more like conversations.
Yeah, well, that's what a good interview is.
Yeah. Okay, everybody. Night-night.
Good night.